College. Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks. Welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. Well, we had an exciting night last night, did we not? I thought that was one of the most interesting nights that I have had since I've been doing this show. The studio was bugged. And I don't know who did it, but it was bugged. And we had a lot of interference having to do with our audio and with our telephone systems. And it was just tough. It was a tough night. We got through it, though, and the bug has met its demise. We are going to have a Halloween festival, a Halloween party of sorts, here at the Kevin Smith Show. This was suggested by one of our members during our monthly chat that I go in the chat room and spend a couple of hours. And one of our members suggested that we do a Halloween party or Halloween festival online, live, on our private TV channel. And we're going to do it. It's going to be a lot of fun. I've already put together some contests we're going to have, give away some prizes. I'm lining up some special guests to be with us. I hope in person, some by video, and I think it's just going to be fabulous. It costs $5 to attend the party. All right. Now, this was suggested to me by one of our members. We were talking about ways to support the show, and this was one of the ideas. $5. You know, you're going to spend more than that on candy, right? Well, save your teeth, and save yourself from perhaps an early onset of diabetes by not buying as much candy. Spend $5 with us, and then spend Halloween evening with us. After the show that night, we will continue, and we'll do so on the private TV channel. And that means you have to have a password to get in. But tell you what we're going to do. Here's what we're going to do. When you subscribe or register for the party, you spend your $5. You're immediately going to be taken to a download page where you can download a special ebook that I picked out just for this event. It's called The Haunted House, written by Walter Hubble. And it's based on true events, scary stuff, decades before the Amityville horror. You'll love it. So the first 100 people that sign up for the party are going to get the free ebook that I just mentioned. All right. Now, the link for that is not on the website yet. That's because I'm running behind. It'll be up on the website by later tonight. And you can sign up for the party. And you'll be able to download your ebook right then. And then you will be able to be taken to a page where you'll be given the password to get in to that private TV channel for that night. Okay? All right. Now, this is... a really, really special night. We have Robert Morningstar who will be with us, and we're going to be talking about some heavy stuff. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. I was notified by a flash message during that break that our video feed was not working, but our audio was doing just fine. The radio feed was doing fine. So we rebooted that. Probably a little bit of technical glitch as a result of having to move everything looking for the bug last night. But it should be working now. And if it's not, I'm trusting that the person who sent me that email will so notify me and let me know. Down in Mexico, they're asking, are we on the air? The answer is yes, we are on the air. All right. My guest this evening is Robert Morningstar. Now, those of us who were alive the day that President John F. Kennedy was murdered in Dallas, Texas, will always remember where we were and what we were doing at the very moment we heard the news that the president had been shot. I, for one, knew some of the people that were involved in some way or another with those tragic events. I don't mean that I knew people who were involved in the assassination, but I knew people who were involved in the many events that had to happen after the gunman's trigger was pulled. Even though I was in elementary school, I knew for certain that the world had changed that day forever. I knew somehow that the future was going to be a little bit darker. As I said, my guest this evening is Robert Morningstar. Now, he has advanced a fairly radical theory about the JFK assassination, a theory that has raised more than one eyebrow across this country. And when I say that his theory is radical, I use that in the very best sense of the word. I mean that his theory departs from the official version so tremendously that it really tells a completely different story of this tragic day in Dallas, Texas, my hometown. Robert Morningstar, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
Robert, I went over and spent some time reading your material. If you click on Robert's picture on our website, it'll take you to a site where his research and photographs are. And I've spent some time going over that, reading that, and I have to say you make a very interesting and a very compelling case.
Thank you.
Part of that case, there's so much there, there's no way we can deal with all of it tonight, but part of what you say and what you have said to me personally about the JFK assassination is that the JFK assassination was in some way linked with, or may in some way have been linked with John Kennedy's plan to disclose information about UFOs.
Yes, indeed. That's becoming ever more clear as years go by.
I want us to talk about that first, and then I want us to talk about this really, really eye-raising, eyebrow-raising theory that you have regarding J.D. Tippit, the police officer who was murdered, ostensibly by Lee Harvey Oswald. But first, let's talk about this UFO angle and why you think that there's a linkage between UFO disclosure and the assassination of the president. What brings you to that conclusion?
Primarily, the emergence of something called the Byrne Memo recently, and during the last 2 years, brought forth out of the majestic documents research of Dr. Robert Wood and Ryan Wood. And there was a time when I would never speak about UFOs because I was involved in the JFK assassination. I knew that he had a great interest in UFOs and that his propulsion or driving of the space program as a primary force in American science in the 60s was connected to that interest that he had in space affairs. Lyndon Johnson as well. But the emergence of the Byrne Memo, with my background in the JFK assassination history and facts as I know them, really, as you say, use the phrase, raise your eyebrows. Well, when I saw the Byrne Memo, my eyebrows wrapped back because I couldn't believe what I was reading and the references that were made, both in code, actually, to having to liquidate the President of the United States.
All right, let's talk about that.
Yeah.
Let's talk about what's in this memo and give us the lowdown. Where does this? Who wrote the memo? Where does it come from? And why do they call it the Byrne Memo?
The Byrne Memo takes its name from singe marks on this carbon copy that was saved by someone. Someone in the CIA saved a memo that was being burned. He pulled it out and somehow got it to Bob Wood and Ryan Wood, who published it as part of their flying saucer related documents. And in the memo, it refers to Lancer, which was President Kennedy's code name. It refers to the 5412 committee, which is and which was the basic assassination apparatus of the CIA and the NSA.
And what was it called, the 5412?
Yes, it was called the 5412 Committee. It was the molting, it was the third version of a covert operations team. It's the same team that's referred to as the secret team by Colonel Fletcher Prouty.
Okay.
So if you know his work and his book, The Secret Team, he's talking about a very high echelon intelligence operations group that was used to eliminate undesirables, and that included heads of state. So that's the group that was used or planned to be used to eliminate Castro. And so it appears that when Kennedy changed his policy in the middle of the Bay of Pigs affair, the apparatus that had been aimed at Castro was turned around and directed at him.
All right, now who wrote this memo?
The 12 committee was engaged in what is euphemistically called in intelligence operations, wet operations. And so the memo makes references to the weather in Washington, and that references when the weather is wet, you know, that the mandate of the 5412 committee has to wait for precipitation and for the weather to become wet. So it's something that I recognized as code for assassination plans.
Who wrote this
memo?
No
one really knew how they were related to UFOs, except that it came out of a UFO trove of documents.
Okay, but who wrote the memo?
Well, my theory is that the memo was written by James Angleton. Dr. Michael Sollick came out with this story, but he made a rather big mistake. He assigns the writing of the memo to Alan Dulles, who was sacked by Kennedy 2 years earlier after the Bay of Pigs affair, and so was not in a power to write this memo. Dr. Sala misinterprets it as a memo that's directed to any president who should broach the subject of revealing UFOs to the American public. But Lancer is and was a unique code name that designated President Kennedy, and his wife's code name was Lace. A lot of these code names, you can come across them if you read William Manchester's The Death of the President, which is quite a remarkable book and has an equally remarkable story behind it, in that it was commissioned by Mrs. Kennedy as the official biography or official account of the death of President Kennedy. And he wrote the book, and when it was going to be published, she came under very heavy pressure from the Johnson administration not to allow that to be published. And so Manchester was sued in court not to publish the book that had been he had been commissioned to publish. And so he had to rewrite the whole book. And it turned it into quite an interesting mishmash of facts, which you have to extricate from the context by going through it with a fine-tooth comb. And my method for doing that was to go through with a yellow marker, for example, in regard to the death of Tippett and the rigmarole that occurred with the coffins, the Britannia coffin and the metal shipping coffin, and the cheap one and the one with the broken handles. It's a long, long, arduous tale. So in reading Manchester, I had to go through it with a yellow marker so that I would mark only the sentences that mentioned Tippett's death, or the casket, or the bodies, and then extract all of those sentences and make them into paragraphs to understand what Manchester was hinting at. And it's something that I no longer hint at all, since I feel I have raised enough proofs to sustain it.
Okay, now this memo, tell us what the memo says about Lancer and about the assassination.
Well, it basically says that the situation is growing grim, and that it seems that there's a danger of divulgence of the UFO phenomenon. And if the attitude in Washington persists in that direction, it's going to be necessary to take executive action to stop divulgence of that information. That, in a sense, is a paraphrase. But I would recommend that you go to majesticdocuments.com, and you'll see it there, along with all the other documents that the father and son, Robert and Ryan Wood, have brought to the public.
All right. Here's an interesting little side note. There was an investigation. Of course, there was the Warren Commission, and everyone on the Warren Commission had ties in one way or another to the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
There was an investigation later having to do with was the CIA involved in... And it was generally it was investigating CIA assassinations of foreign leaders.
Yes.
And there was a there's a guy by the name of David Belin.
Yes.
B-E-L-I-N.
Yes, he was one of the lawyers.
Mm-hmm. Former assistant counsel to the Warren Commission.
Right.
He wrote a book called Final Disclosure, The Full Truth About the Assassination of President Kennedy, and he was the executive director of the Rockefeller Commission in 1975 investigating CIA assassinations of foreign leaders. In giving testimony, before the court, actually before Chairman, I think it's pronounced Thunheim.
It's Thunheim, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Thunheim.
All right. He says that based on very thorough investigation, it can be said categorically that the CIA in no other intelligence apparatus of the United States in no way had anything to do with the assassination of President Kennedy, either directly or indirectly. And when I say directly or indirectly, I'm quoting his testimony.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he has testified to that, apparently under oath.
Mm-hmm.
You are saying that there is evidence that that is not true.
Well, it seems that the church committee, the committee to which you're alluding, to where he testified, produced a chronicle of America's and the CIA's involvement in political assassinations and listed the evolution of the assassination apparatus as it evolved through the years. But this part of the church committee report was kept top secret and not released to the public until I came across it only about 8 months ago. You know, I go into my research, my investigation, data drilling, as they call it, and somehow I latch onto this stream of awareness and curiosity that leads me through lateral thinking and to different troves of information. And I found the report that had been classified top secret for all these years, and it chronicles the formation of several committees. The first one was called the 10-2 Committee. The second one, the following year, was changed to the 10-5 Committee. And then around 1954, it became the 54-12 Committee. This was the committee that was under the direction, assigned to be under the direction of the Vice President of the United States. And this is where Richard Nixon comes into the Cuban scene as the fellow who was handling this committee with a contingency plan to assassinate Castro and invade Cuba, and with full expectations of being elected President of the United States in 1960, expectations which were derailed by John F. Kennedy. Now, John F. Kennedy came into office, and all of this was kept secret from him, even though Nixon, the Vice President, under the direction of President Eisenhower, knew all about this. The new president was not apprised of it. He wasn't told of the existence of the 54-12 Committee, and he wasn't told of the existence of the plans to invade Cuba. So on the morning of the early morning in April, I believe it was, 1961, when the invasion of Cuba at the Bay of Pigs was already underway, he got a call advising him of the invasion and asking if he would permit U.S. aircraft to give them ground support.
Okay, we have to step away for a break. We'll pick up right there when we come back. And I would like to ask those of you who are listening and watching, somebody send, do me a flash message and let me know if the video is working for you now. We'll be back right after this. Right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest, Robert Morningstar. We're talking about his research and his theory about the assassination of President John Kennedy. Robert, when we went away, we were talking about this memo, and we were talking about this committee, the 54-12 Committee.
That's right.
Okay, I want to nail down the UFO aspect.
Okay.
All right. When did
really begins with another memo in not memo, it's actually a report in the Majestic document series. And this one's called the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit Report, going back to 1947 and the Roswell crash. And it itemizes point by point, I believe it's 14 points, of the retrieval, the discovery, the retrieval, and the conclusions made about the crashed UFO at Roswell. When you get to point 11, and this is a report made by the Central Intelligence Group, as it was called in 1947 before CIA was formed. It evolved out of something called Central Intelligence Group, which was part of Army and Army Air Force. And it notes that Congressman John F. Kennedy of Massachusetts, son of Joseph Kennedy, member of the President's Commission on the Reorganization of the Government, had learned of the event at Roswell, having been briefed by a staff member of the Secretary of the United States Air Force, whose name was Stuart Symington at the time. It notes that President Kennedy, to be president, then congressman, had flown from Boston to Washington, accompanied by a staff member of the Secretary of the Air Force, and it was revealed to him what had happened. And in fact, it puts him on a watch list. It means basically that he had found out, and that he was a person of interest, as you would call them today, a person who had to be watched because he had this information that had been received really unauthorized manner, simply through his connections. So that's where the Kennedy, John F. Kennedy connection starts.
Okay, now you brought up something I want to ask you about. You may know about it, you may not. You said that he was briefed by Stuart Symington.
The staff member, it refers to a staff member of the Secretary of the Air Force, and yes, this is the same Symington family that you're going to talk about.
Fife Symington?
Yes, I asked Fife Symington in Washington if he was related to Stuart Symington, and he said he was a nephew.
Okay. All right, so Kennedy was at that point a congressman, and he was put on a watch list.
Basically, this was like a security report of how far the information had traveled, for example, and how people had been told to be quiet, and how members of the community had been advised to be quiet, you know, according to their regular security procedures. But this was a special case, you know, this was a congressman, so they couldn't go in and browbeat him and threatened to plant his family out in the desert, as they did to some of the other Roswell families and witnesses.
Okay, so let's fast forward now.
Pardon?
Let's fast forward, because that's how Kennedy got involved with it. But at what point did Kennedy make it known that he was going to disclose UFO information to the public when he was president? How did that happen, and when?
Well, it appears that President Kennedy became obsessed with this horrible prospect of nuclear holocaust unfolding accidentally upon the world. He had come to the brink of nuclear war during the Cuban Missile Crisis and had successfully resolved it by outthinking both his opponent, Khrushchev, but outthinking and outwitting the Joint Chief of Staff, his advisors, who misinterpreted many of the, let's call them signs or signals that were being received, you know, during the crisis. He successfully navigated through that, but it's something that basically gave him a harrowing experience. And one of the things that bothered President Kennedy was that the UFO phenomenon, as it was being tracked by NORAD and our DEW line and the Bemuse system, he knew that this could accidentally trigger a nuclear war, because often these UFO incursions into Canadian air entry through Canadian airspace heading toward the United States were misinterpreted as ballistic missiles that could have been coming from Russia. So his desire was to eliminate this possibility, this misidentification, and he really got to work on it after June 1963 because of something that I'm going to relate to you in a couple of seconds. But basically, the key date is November 12, 1963, 10 days before his assassination. He had a lengthy conversation with James R. Webb, the director of NASA. And he called upon him, and this is contained in a memo that he wrote to James R. Webb, expressing his desire that the classification system of unknowns, and that was their code word for UFOs. He wanted to know all list of all unknowns. He wanted them to work with Air Force, NASA, Navy, and even the Russians to classify and reclassify all unknowns and separate them into CIA secret projects, Air Force secret projects, Navy secret projects, NASA, and so on. And, you know, the ones that they suspected were Russians. Eliminate all of those and find out what were the real UFOs. Because he feared that UFOs could contrive a plan, if it was intentionally malicious, or just haphazardly, incidentally, be misinterpreted as a missile attack that would precipitate a nuclear exchange with Russia. So on that day, he had a conversation with James R. Webb.
Now, tell us the date again.
November 12th.
Uh-huh.
And on the same date, he had a conversation with Premier Nikita Khrushchev. And in very tactful language, discusses some of these aspects and the need to know and share information with each other. And that's also a document that's on the Majestic document site from Dr. Robert Wood. And it's clear that that date he was making very, very quick decisions. As a matter of fact, one of the most interesting items that I have in my archives is a doodle that was made by President Kennedy around November 10th, November 12th, 1963. It was released by the Kennedy Library about 4 years ago. And it is remarkable. It is remarkable. It shows a man, and it shows a face like the moon, and a man jumping over the moon, and then it shows these lozenges and discs, and the lozenges are connected in five elements, and it says System 5. And then there, it shows the Earth, a little doodle of the Earth and the North Pole, and there are all these egg shapes, UFO shapes over the North Pole. And some of them have dollar signs, like the U.S. dollar sign mm-hmm. of the UFOs.
Yep.
And others don't have dollar signs. And some, it's symbolically, it's something that represents to me his concerns that something was occurring over the polar caps, and some of it was U.S., and some of it was Russians, and some of it was unknown. And System 5, to me, refers to the Saturn 5 system and getting the man on the moon. It's quite a remarkable little doodle that I read in different. I read differently than most people do because I understand Chinese. I read and write Chinese characters. And ideographic language and doodling is very similar. I'll share it with you one of these days. I'll dig it up out of my archives and send it to you. It's quite fascinating.
Okay, so we're looking at November the
July. Okay,
November the 12th
from Dr. Michael Wolff on Bill Nell's presidential UFO experiences, and it said that in the account states that on June 23rd, 1963, while yachting off Martha's Vineyard, the president's party was on the Honey Fitz, that yacht, the famous yacht that he had. And a UFO came down and hovered about 200 feet from his boat.
And this is on the same date?
Excuse me?
This is on the same date, November 12th?
No, this would be June 23rd.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm saying that by November 12th, he was quite wound up because this particular incident probably sparked him. Because the description is that the craft was seen 200 feet off the water, off Martha's Vineyard, 200 feet away from his craft, his boat, and 60 feet above the water, and that the Secret Service and the President and everyone grew very excited and no one really knew what to do. And all of a sudden, this thing went vertically, zip, and went straight up into the sky.
Okay.
And that President Kennedy was as excited as anyone else, you know, with this happening, having seen it. But he took all of his guests aside and swore them to secrecy.
All right, now
one
look.
One of them was his cousin, who was
we've got
to
this,
Dr. Wolf.
We've got this memo mm-hmm. called the Burned Memo.
Mm-hmm.
This memo references that Lancer, basically, and this is my paraphrase, is getting out of control
exactly.
on this UFO thing.
Yes.
Okay. What is it that memo is responding to? Did he hold a meeting and say, I'm going to disclose it? Did he write a memo?
Okay, here it is.
Mm-hmm.
This coupled with the memo that it was written to James R. Webb puts this whole thing together, in that the conversation with James R. Webb tipped off CIA, James Jesus Angleton, Cord Meyer, all the people, the highest people, General Cabell. Remember I mentioned General Cabell, who was fired along with Dulles, had been the number two man in the CIA in UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the guys that was sacked by President Kennedy.
Okay, so Kennedy talks with Webb. What does he say to Webb? What does he say, I'm going to do it?
Basically, from the memo, I can tell you that he said what I said before. He wanted a complete reclassification of all unknowns, and he wanted the report on his desk by February of 1964. So the inference is that he wanted a new reclassification of all these UFOs, but he also mandates that James R. Webb contact the Russian.
All right, we have to step away for a break. We'll be back, folks, right after this. My guest this evening is Robert Morningstar. We're talking about his research into the assassination of John F. Kennedy as it relates specifically to the topic of UFOs. All right, when we went away for break, you were just talking about James R. Webb had been ordered by the president
right.
to put a report on his desk by February 1964, detailing the classification of all unknowns. Are they ours? Are they Russian? Or are they truly unknowns? Okay,
right.
And this was James R. Webb. He's CIA, so he reports this.
He was NASA. He was NASA, but equally important, he was the former head of the Office of Budget and Management. And he, in fact, was the primary engineer who fashioned the military-industrial complex. And I'd like to come back to this point later, but that's who James R. Webb was.
Okay, so he funnels the information then to James Jesus Angleton.
Okay, that's correct. That's correct. Whatever touched this subject, and that's how we get Angleton associated with this memo, because the document released regarding the president's request is actually it's his memo to Webb. On it, it says Angleton has MJ executive. And we know that that means James Jesus Angleton, the chief of counterintelligence.
Yeah, and he was, what he's saying there is he's MJ1.
That's right. And he became MJ1 after Dulles was sacked.
Yeah.
You see?
Okay, so...
The hierarchy went from DCI, but when Dulles was eliminated, you can imagine Dulles having been in charge almost since the inception. It was just a couple of years. They had two admirals and then Dulles and a general, and then Dulles became director around 52. So he'd been in there quite a long time, and then in OSSF before that. So he was a man who wore many hats in CIA. So when they got rid of him, you know, Kennedy got rid of him, all of his responsibilities devolved on other luminaries in the CIA.
Okay, so Angleton is now MJ1, and this memo comes out that you think that Angleton is probably who wrote it,
mm-hmm.
and the memo, we call it the burned memo.
The burned memo as well.
Okay, so he writes the burned memo that mm-hmm. says Lancer is becoming a little too uncontrollable, and the mm-hmm. weather may have to get wet in Washington or something like
that. That's correct. Exactly right.
Okay.
And the weather may have to get wet in Washington is an oblique reference to an intelligence term calling wet affairs for wet affairs.
Yeah.
And wet affairs is a euphemism for liquidation or assassination.
Yeah. Okay, now...
Wet works is what the Russians called it.
When was... What's the date on that burned memo?
I don't recall at the moment.
Okay. Shortly after the burned memo, President Kennedy is in Texas.
Yes.
And he's in the motorcade going through Dallas. And he is assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
Now... You explored a great deal of the connection between the UFO topic, the UFO subject, and the assassination. Let's talk about the assassination itself. Now,
can I backtrack? Just one slight,
sure.
important historical note. The first people to know, after Roswell, the first people to know of the UFO crash, crashes, plural, that occurred in Roswell and Kingman, those areas, were the Dallas oil industrialists and the Dallas Fort Worth Air Force people who received the debris that was flown in, as opposed to debris that was trucked out. It got out in a lot of different ways.
Well, and you said it's the Dallas oil industrialists. How did they get into this?
Because one of the flying saucers was discovered by a bunch of oil men first, who had a good time, a good hour and a half or two before the military got there. And they went into it, they explored it. That's another story. But those guys knew about it. The military came in, silenced them all, swore them to secrecy. But you know how good old boys are. Once they got back to the office, I'm sure they all started talking about it.
Do you know who they were?
Excuse me?
Do you know who they were?
No, I don't. The closest I've ever gotten to identification is a story that says that they worked for Howard Hughes Industries.
Okay.
That's about as close as I can come to an identification. But the other part is the mystical part of this thing and the dreadful consequences that followed the discovery of the debris and the bodies, both the alien bodies and the human bodies that apparently were contained in the craft. And not to mention... The psychological and actual physical illnesses that were suffered by people that handled this situation.
Now, I've never heard
one
about
of the things. One of the memo's points, the IPU memo, cites that three MPs committed suicide. And then there's another story about contamination with some unknown bacteria or virus that caused hemorrhaging and bleeding in some of the medical people.
Okay, now I've never heard about, I've heard about bodies being found, and I've heard about them being small and very different from us. I've never heard that there were human bodies found dead inside the craft. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's one of the, the phrase is, one of the disturbing discoveries was that certain bodies were found dissected like we do frogs. That's one of the phrases in the IPU. And it's one of the points that William Cooper made when he was revealing a lot of this information back in 88 through the end of his days. He emphasized that that was one of the really horrifying things, and the thing that the military had to keep a lid on, was that there was a vat of human body parts in addition to cattle parts discovered in the Roswell crash.
Okay. Now, let's fast forward to Dallas.
Okay.
And that's we have to come back and do a show about all of that on its own, but I want to deal with the Kennedy thing tonight. Mm-hmm. We fast forward to Dallas. Apparently, Kennedy would have been briefed on that information that you just shared with us. And,
he should have been briefed, but he wasn't. The president, by this time, the president was being excluded from a direct knowledge of... the last president with direct knowledge of this UFO reality and the U.S. government policy was Eisenhower.
Yeah, but you said that Kennedy was briefed when he was a congressman.
Kennedy was briefed on the Roswell crash.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so he would have known about these body parts,
in an unauthorized way, just chit-chat on an airplane. But he found out about it. But throughout his career as congressman, as senator, he was calling for disclosure. He was always asking for information and became a little bit of a pest for the U.S. Air Force. As a matter of fact, one of the interesting stories in Sorensen's book, A Thousand Days, is that even after President Kennedy was already elected, he went for a briefing at Cheyenne Mountain and started asking technical information about Air Force programs.
Okay, we're only 30 seconds away from our next break, and I want to hear this story in its entirety, so why don't we hold that till we come back from this next break?
Okay.
Okay. Folks, look, you miss a single second at a Kevin Smith show, and you miss a universe of information. Fascinating stuff, isn't it? And it gets deeper. Lots, lots deeper. And when we come back from this break, we are going to wade off. You think you've been in the deep water. Nah, we're going to wade off into the deep water when we come back. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. For those of you who are joining us just now in this second hour, I truly, truly feel sorry for you, because you have truly missed boatloads, boatloads of valuable information. We're talking with Robert Morningstar about his research into the Kennedy assassination. And you were about to tell us a story, and I said, let's hold up until after the break, because it was upon us. So the floor is yours, and we're all ears.
Well, basically, President Kennedy had a very antagonistic relationship with the United States Air Force, primarily because he was a Navy man. And we don't understand today in real concrete terms the vitriolic antipathy that existed between different services. The Army hated the Navy. You get a little feeling of that in the Army-Navy football game, but nothing compared to the way it was in the 1950s. And then the Air Force, being an offshoot of the Army, and being the flyboys to the squids and the grunts, you know, that kind of rivalry was really intense, and we don't have an understanding of it,
Okay, but we'll take your word for it. He had a lot of antipathy towards the Air Force.
Well, the Air Force had antipathy for him and his nosy, busybody congressional self throughout his career. So now he's president-elect, and he's asking questions, and they're not giving him answers. And he stormed out of the briefing, and he said to them, okay, we'll see about that next time Air Force appropriations comes up for a vote. You know, and he stormed out of there, and Sorensen makes a note of that incident. Curtis LeMay hated him. When he had a successful reconciliation of the a resolution of the missile crisis, Kennedy had a celebration for the XCOM, the executive committee, that had navigated through this, and he said, we're going to celebrate this, invite everybody, we're going to have a brunch. And when the invitation got to Curtis LeMay, his comment was, we should go in there and shoot those two son of a bitches right now. And that's a quote. That's a historical quote. And so forgive the rudeness, but that's the way Curtis LeMay spoke. And that's contained in an issue of Newsweek dating 1994. So the situation is, it's very, very difficult keeping the lid on this. And as you infer, the Byrne memo says that he can't be controlled. He's also asking questions that need to be redirected or deflected. That's another part of the memo. He's asking these questions. If he asks this question, the best thing is to ask why he asks it and then to redirect it. First, like, oh, why would you ask that? Or ask the Air Force if it's asked the CIA guy, or if the Air Force guy is asked, I says, ask the Navy. So that was their ploy. The interesting thing is this as well. It all devolves around the space program. And up to that date, that visit down to Dallas, the exact location of the Apollo Control Center was still up in the air. It was actually supposed to be up at MIT. And it wasn't until he went down and signed the bill citing Houston to become the space center. That was November 18th, 1963, when he had the tour with Wernher von Braun and saw the fundamentals of the Saturn program, the Saturn V program. So it comes down to this situation where Kennedy was radically changing U.S. government policy on secrecy, on energy. He was going to get rid of the oil depletion allowance. He was going to get rid of the Federal Reserve. He had double-crossed the mafia. I mean, he had alienated the Ku Klux Klan and the Minutemen throughout the South by calling for civil rights. And so all of these diverse interests, had a common interest in seeing him eliminated. So as it turned out, the 5412 committee apparatus was turned on President Kennedy. In the same way that they had enlisted the mafia to try to assassinate Castro, they enlisted mafia mechanics and French mafia professional assassins and local members of the Ku Klux Klan who were in the Dallas Police Department to all collude to make this global theater occur.
All right, yeah. Now, got a question or two here.
Sure.
You said the 5412, the attention of the 5412 was turned on to Kennedy.
Yep.
5412 is, as you have told us, an assassination squad, so to speak.
Yes.
How do you know that? How do you know the 5412 was turned towards Kennedy?
Well, I know the function of the 5412 and its history from the church committee report that I mentioned briefly.
I understand that, but how do you know they turned their attention to Kennedy?
Well, the players involved, and Johnny Roselli, you remember that guy?
Yeah.
The mafia, the Miami mafia fellow, Johnny Roselli, who was involved in the plot to kill Castro. His involvement in the Kennedy assassination also points to this redirection of the 5412 committee's attention to Kennedy.
Okay, so there's not like a memo or a paper trail that tells us that the 5412...
Other than the Byrne memo, no.
Okay.
But the Byrne memo is pretty hot information.
All right, now, Kennedy is traveling in Dallas. He's in a motorcade.
Mm-hmm.
At the last minute, and I've always, even when I was a kid, I mean, and I was a kid in elementary school when the assassination took place, but even when I was a kid, I thought this was just weird. Right at the last minute, there was a change in the route.
Right.
Just
many reasons.
Just before the assassination, the Secret Service guys vacate the president's car.
Mm-hmm.
After the president has been shot, you can see in the Zapruder film, you can see Secret Service guys running toward the car from behind.
Mm-hmm.
What in God's name was Secret Service doing away from the president's car?
Well, you know, there are several aspects to this story. And one of them, one of the important things to note is that President Kennedy knew that someone was gunning for him. And he had to have known this as early as November 18th, because it was in Miami when he went to address the Cuban community in the Orange Bowl that his motorcade route was not changed. It was completely eliminated, and he was flown by helicopter into the Orange Bowl instead of traveling through Miami in a motorcade. And this was because it was already known that there were plots against President Kennedy in Miami, in Chicago, and in Dallas. And it's this Miami investigation that gave me the lead, or another element of proof in the the JFK Tippit body swap scenario that we're going to discuss in a couple of minutes.
Yeah, all right. We're going to have to get into that pretty quick because we're going to run out of time.
Okay.
Now, okay, who made the decision that the president's route was going to change? Someone had to give that order.
That's always been a mystery. No one avows responsibility, except that it had to be approved by Lawson, one of the local Dallas Secret Service guys who was in charge of all of that. William Lawson is the fellow who had to have okayed the change in the route, which precipitated many dangerous turns, slowing down, directing him under a railroad bridge that was full of people, that should have been empty of any spectators, but was jam-packed with railroad workers, Dallas police guarding the deaf-mute fellow that we often saw on the History Channel, the men who killed Kennedy, who saw the shot from the grassy knoll and the breaking down of one of the rifles. So there's a lot of things wrong there, and some of it has to do with some of the most more esoteric things that I discussed with you briefly.
All right, now I want to jump ahead to the Tippit thing because I'm very, very curious about this.
Okay.
We know that someone or some persons pulled the trigger or triggers, and they killed the president.
Right.
And this is what all the debate has been about. The big debate has been about, was there one gunman or were there more? Now, I think the easiest way to know that there, I mean, if, even if you don't have any film, the easiest way to know that there were gunmen behind the fence at the grassy knoll is that everyone on the grassy knoll hit the ground because they heard a shot come from behind them.
Correct.
And one of those people was a U.S. Marine just back from boot camp, and the bullet went past his left ear.
That's correct. That's Gordon Arnold. I believe he was an Army guy, and he was transferred to Alaska immediately afterwards.
Okay, now, but let's move on to Tippit. Shortly after, within about, 40 to 45 minutes after the assassination, after the shots that hit the president, there's a Dallas police officer on patrol. It's always been mysterious about why did he stop, but he stopped. And the story is that he talked with Oswald, and that Oswald and he got into some sort of an argument. Oswald pulls a revolver and shoots him.
Right. That's the story.
Okay. Now, it so happens that police officer is one of the people I knew. And
yes, I was very surprised to hear that.
I still know his family.
Yeah.
Okay, now we'll deal with the police officer in a minute.
Okay.
I want to read to you something that I know to be not true. Okay. This, again, is testimony from David Balin.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, and this is a quote from his testimony before the church commission, or church committee. Not only do you have six eyewitnesses who identified Oswald as the gunman, talking about the gunman who shot Tippit, but you found cartridge cases at the scene of the Tippit murder, which Barbara Davis, Virginia Davis, and a witness by the name of Domingo Benavides turned over to the police. Those cartridge cases came from Oswald's revolver that he pulled out in the Texas theater as the police approached. Okay, here's what I know. I really should have backed up and...
maybe I can do it.
No, I want to read this, and I want to tell you exactly what I know can't be true. Scoggins identified Oswald as the gunman, so did five other witnesses, and then the statement that I read follows that. The problem with that is the witnesses described someone with dark skin, possibly Mexican-American or maybe Cuban.
That's right.
They did not identify Oswald.
So what we're having here is the testimony of a mouthpiece for the Warren Commission to bolster up the false conclusion that they foisted upon the nation.
All right. Now, this testimony was under oath in front of the church committee.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right.
Now, got a question about this because his testimony says they turned over cartridges. How many shots were fired into J.D. Tippit?
Tippit was shot through the chest, through the side. One bullet hit a button that gouged his abdomen. And the final shot, the coup de grace, as it is called in French precisely for what it was, the gunman walked over to Tippit and put the gun to his temple and fired a single bullet into his brain. So I would say five shots.
All right, do you know if this was a five or a six-shot revolver?
Now, here's the problem. Some people saw two people
at
the scene.
That's
one of the discrepancies in what Bellin is saying.
You know? Mm-hmm.
There was a woman named Akilah Clemens whose brother was murdered when she began to testify about this, that she had seen two men, and one of them described as you did, and the other description of a gray car racing away. But the more important part is this, that it seems that the fire was very rapid, and the police officer named Poe, who came upon the scene, treated the the evidence very professionally. He lifted up the cartridges with a pencil, but he made a point of somehow handling it and initialing his initials on the back of the cartridge. And he claimed later on that the cartridges that were shown to him at a later time were not the ones that he had found and did not have his initials.
Okay. Was it a five-shot or a six-shot revolver?
Well, Oswald had a five-shot revolver, as I understand.
Okay.
A six-shot revolver. But these the cartridge is important because these cartridges came out of an automatic weapon. And
okay.
some of these cartridges were not interchangeable.
No, they're not.
Revolver.
All right, and here's another thing. I can't imagine that having just shot Tippett with a revolver that you would take, it only takes a split second, but you would not take the time to dump cartridges on the ground out of the, you have to open the revolver, you have to hit the ejector rod mm-hmm. and knock those out. There's, mm-hmm. if it's a six shot, he's still got one bullet that hasn't been fired, and it's going to hit the ground as well. Mm-hmm. All right, it wasn't found there.
Mm-hmm.
So that means he picked it up and either put it back in the gun or in his pocket and took off.
Mm-hmm.
This doesn't make sense when you've just shot a cop right out in public.
Right. Here's another discrepancy. They claim to have found a wallet, Oswald's wallet, at the Tippett death scene. But when Oswald was being taken to the police station with his hands handcuffed behind his back in the cruiser, in the squad car, he said to them, "Excuse me, can you move me? Can I move? Because I'm sitting on my wallet and it's hurting me."
Mm-hmm.
So we have this case of two wallets, two Oswalds, and if you study the work of John Armstrong, you will really get a very, very interesting education in intelligence operations and the uses of doubles.
Okay, speaking of doubles, your theory says that the body that was buried as John Kennedy was in fact J.D. Tippett.
Yes, and I quote Mrs. Kennedy upon viewing that body, reported in the death of a president by William Manchester, saying, "That's not Jack. That looks like something that came out of Madame Tussaud's wax museum." His other, the other advisors, Bill Walton, Schlesinger, Robert Kennedy, they all said it doesn't look like him either. It's
all
ghastly.
Right.
The reason I'm discussing this is because they got to see the body and to make the decision whether or not to have an open casket. And it was decided after that it was not appropriate to have an open casket, especially after Jackie Kennedy's comment.
Now, there's some similarity. They don't look like twins, but there's some similarity between John F. Kennedy and Officer J.D. Tippett.
Yes.
Now, unless you happen to be watching as we're talking, you won't see this, but I've got a picture of President Kennedy right up next to a picture of Officer J.D. Tippett. Now, what we're going to do here is we're going to just impose or superimpose the face of J.D. Tippett over Kennedy's face. And people can see that happening. While there are some similarities, I can definitely see the difference between them.
Yes, indeed. And here is where we get to the crux of the matter in the discrepancies on descriptions of the head wound as seen by the Secret Servicemen, Siebert and O'Neill, in Dallas. They saw the body and traveled with it from Dallas to Washington. And when they got to Washington, they noticed and they said it was obvious that some surgery had been done to the top of the head, specifically the skull. Now, this discrepancy was picked up by David Lifton, and it becomes a very important element in this whole story about the nature of the wounds, where the bullet entered, the difference in the testimony of the Parkland doctors with the Bethesda autopsists and the medical people who saw the bodies, like the Navy corpsmen, whom I know. I know the two of the corpsmen, Commander Dennis David, and I knew Paul O'Connor, who handled the bodies in Bethesda, and they told me horrifying stories, and that nothing in the Warren Commission is true. So the discrepancy is this. If you look at the pictures, you see that Tippett had a balding, receding hairline, and that this was distinctly different from the full head of hair that President Kennedy had.
Yeah.
There is a gruesome photograph that's purported to be President Kennedy. It's called a Stare of Death photo. The other one is called the Devil's Ear, because there's a very strange flap of flesh shown in the photograph. Well, to make a long story short, the person depicted is actually J.D. Tippett, and the surgery that was necessary to mask that fact was to reflect the skull backwards and cover up the real nature of the wounds to make it look as if a single bullet had done it, had killed the president. And so basically the problem for the assassination team, the operations and the planning group, was to triangulate fire on the president, to shoot him from varying angles, some high and from behind, some low and from the front, and almost everyone hit him. So you have a body that's brought in, and it's obviously been shot from behind and high and from the front as well, and that says more than one killer. So the only way to get around that was to provide a body to the autopsist that was shot from one direction. And what they did is they presented the brain of Officer Tippett that had truly been shot and killed by one bullet through the head, and that's the brain that they autopsied. That brain weighed 1,500 cc's, which is quite heavier than the normal human brain of about 1,200 cc's. But we know from the testimony and the eyewitness testimony that we have in seeing the Zapruder film that more than half the president's brain was liquefied that day in Dallas, and that another portion of it drained out of the wound in the back of his head while he was in trauma room 1 at Parkland Hospital. So what remained of President Kennedy's brain after 1:30 in the afternoon on November 22, 1963, was, I would say, at the most, one-third to one-half of a brain.
And all right, we have to step away for a break. It's going to take over here in about 10 seconds. And when we come back, folks, we'll wrap up a little bit with Robert, and then we'll open the phone lines for you, okay? So we'll be back right after this. Back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking with Robert Morningstar. Robert, very quickly, I got to ask you this question. Why?
Sure.
Why swap bodies?
Because if you present a body to the autopsist that shows a bullet hole into the throat from the front, a bullet hole dropping into the shoulder blade area at a 40 degree angle, it says 40 to 60 degree angle down into the body, and a head wound that, for all intents and purposes, appeared to come from the front, or twice from the front. I'm not joking. Twice from the front, because he was hit simultaneously. He received a glancing blow from one shot that missed him and didn't miss him. It bounced off like a billiard ball and took care of Governor Connolly in its flight. But the head wound can only be explained as two shots, one from the right front that opened the head, and almost immediately thereafter, one from the front that entered the open wound and blew out the back of the head. So there you have the real physics of the John F. Kennedy head wound.
All right, now have you...
Frames have been removed from the Zapruder film. None of that can be seen, because they had to take away the intervening space and the arrival of one, two, three, four, at least four shots that hit him, and make it look like one magic bullet did most of the damage.
The magic bullet theory, I think, came from Arlen Specter, didn't it?
Indeed, it did. And here we have another connection. to the United States Air Force.
All right, now.
Black.
All right.
Because Arlen Specter was a member of the U.S. Air Force, and he was a member of AFOSI, the Air Force Office of Special Investigations.
All right. Now, when you started researching all of this and you started formulating this theory, at any point have you talked with any member of the Tippit family about all of this?
No, the Tippit family is very reclusive and stays out of the limelight and doesn't talk to anyone, and so I've never had the opportunity or the privilege of speaking to Mrs. Tippit.
Well,
the only person that I would really be interested in speaking to, since the children were all very young, you know?
As you well, were, two of them were. Two. One was a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
But Alan was a teenager, but the other two were young. Okay, now, and you've got that right. She does, the Tippit family does pretty much stay out of the limelight. Well, not pretty much, they do stay out of the limelight. And they're very private. Okay, now, we're going to open up the telephone line and allow folks to call in. And folks, when you call, if you will, state your question or your comment, and then take your answer off the air so we can get as many calls in as possible, okay? So as soon as you've stated your question or your comment, we'll move on to the answer and the next call. The telephone number is 623-444-5889. Toll free is 888-223-4599. If you live outside of the USA and you live outside of Canada, you can send me a flash message, and you do that by going to my website, scrolling down to where you see a link that says flash message. But you need to be, you must be outside the USA and outside of Canada. I get asked sometimes why. Well, the answer to why is simple. We have telephones for you to use in the USA and Canada, and I even pay for the call. Okay? So, 623-444-5889 or 888-223-4599. Who was buried in Tippit's coffin?
I don't know that anybody's in the coffin. It looked awfully light to me as they lifted it. By comparison to the struggle that the Secret Servicemen had wielding the Britannia casket, when I see the films of the Tippit funeral and notice that one of the latches on that silver casket was unlatched, they lift it up very, very easily and swing it into the hearse. So I'm not sure that anybody was buried in Tippit's coffin. As we discussed day before yesterday, no woman saw the body. His family was not allowed to see the body, and a disinformation story was published immediately that day. For example, I read it in the New York Times stating that Tippit had been shot in the eye and horribly disfigured, and as a result, no one was allowed to see the body. So, and both bodies apparently were taken to Washington.
I was at the funeral.
The theory of the autopsy, I recommend one of the finest books ever written, if not the definitive book on it, is called Best Evidence by David Lifton. That's the one that opened my eyes to all of the paradoxes in the medical evidence. And he describes a very, very strange affair in the autopsy, in that there were curtains drawn and autopsists were told to get out of the room and the body was wheeled, and then they were told to come back in the room and only touch this part and only look at that part, and then they were told to get out of the room and go someplace else, and they heard the body being moved and the body was turned over, and then they were called in and they said, okay, do that part now. It's a very, very strange theatrical affair, and I call it global theater. And it was the planting of the disinformation. And these poor guys, you know, Humes, Boswell, and Fink, they had never done an autopsy before in their lives. And the top autopsists in the nation had called in and said, I'll volunteer to do this autopsy. But the military clamped down and used these three military doctors pulled this rigmarole. And this is what I'm describing to you.
Well, there's something else you're describing. If what you say is true, what you're describing is something that involved at least the CIA, and it would have involved the Army, the Air Force.
And the Navy.
And the Navy.
The Naval Hospital, which is the same place where Secretary of Defense James Forrestal went out a window.
All right. So what you're describing here is a coup d'etat.
Exactly. As I said to you, people say to me, why do you care about the John F. Kennedy assassination? And I reply, the John F. Kennedy assassination is not over. What we are going through, the crises that we are going through in this nation right now, the financial crisis, the Fed, the erosion of our freedoms, the rewriting of our laws, the changing of our courts, all of that began on November 22nd, 1963 as a 50-year, 60-year process to bring down this nation, to subvert it.
We're going to get back to that in just a moment. Okay. I want to take this telephone call. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? Caller's not ready to speak. All right. 623-444-5889. Or toll free at 888-223-4599. You know, when you call in and then you go away to listen to the show, you're hearing what happened 12 seconds ago. That's why you miss it. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? Hello, caller. And the caller is not there.
I heard hello there.
Yep. Well, if you listen to your radio instead of listening to your phone, you will mess up. Okay? 623-444-5889 or toll-free 888-223-4599. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. It's Stephen calling from Anaheim.
Hi, Stephen.
Hey, I just want to let you know that you sound like you're really far away, like you're on the moon or something. And I called the first couple times and it hung up on me. It was really weird.
Okay, yeah, but you're on the air now, so what's your question?
Okay, for Dick, I had some questions about...
No, this is Robert Morningstar.
I'm sorry, what?
This is not Dick, this is Robert Morningstar.
Oh, Robert, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then I need to rephrase my question. I'll call back. Thank you.
Okay.
Am I starting to sound like Dick Criswell?
I don't think so.
If he's listening, I want to send him my good wishes.
Yeah. All right, 623-444-5889. And caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. This is Paul from New York City.
Yeah, Paul.
I have a question for your guest. I was wondering... if he found any changing of the motorcade that could have been done by Mayor Campbell, whose brother was fired by JFK at one time.
Right. This is one of those intriguing relationships between the Dallas people and the political Dallas people and the military that was fired by President Kennedy. The evidence is overwhelming that the city fathers made the plan, the parade route. And this comes from my conversation with Madeline Brown, who was Lyndon Johnson's mistress for many, many years and was there that night it happened. She relates a story in Texas in the Morning, and she related it to me personally, that on November 8th, 1963, she was with Lyndon Johnson in Jack Ruby's club, and Jack Ruby came over and showed her a map of the motorcade route. This is November 8th now. He showed her a map of the motorcade route for President Kennedy's motorcade November 22nd. And she turned to him and she said, "Wow, Jack, it shows you're really up there with the Great White Fathers." Now, the Great White Fathers is a very interesting term to me because I first heard it in 1961 when I was discussing religion with a Protestant friend of mine who informed me that the Southern Baptists had no pope because I was raised Northern and Catholic. And I said, "Well, who's the pope of the Protestants?" He said, "They don't have a pope. They are directed by the Great White Fathers." So 33 years later, Madeline Brown says this to me, and she's referring to this group of top industrialists, as I call them. You know.
Yeah, I was going to say, I can't imagine that the Southern Baptists had anything to do with it.
Well, if Southern Baptism is a pretty widespread religion, but there was a hardcore religiously oriented group called the Ku Klux Klan, and the other ones were the Minutemen, who had many Ku Klux Klan members in their ranks. And you know, when it comes to this global theater that I've described to you, the way they dressed up the assassination in astronomical terms and Masonic symbolism, executing the president in an outdoor Masonic temple, as Dealey Plaza is.
Explain that now. You're saying that Dealey Plaza is an outdoor Masonic temple.
Yes, it's a monument, and this is well known since the days of William Cooper, who first brought it to my attention. He said, "Go to Dealey Plaza and you'll see. It's an open-air Masonic temple dedicated to the foundations of the first lodge of Freemasonry in Texas, which was right there in that cow pasture that is called Dealey Plaza."
All right, we got to take a break. We come back, we'll take another call or two, and have your fingers ready to do the dialing, all right? Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking with Robert Morningstar. We're just about out of time. If you've been trying to call in and have not been able to make it, now's the time. We're on final approach. We only have a few minutes left. 623-444-5889 or toll free at 888-223-4599. Let's go to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, this is Rex from Miami.
Yes, Rex.
Yeah, I was wondering, Robert, what do you think of the theory about the Kennedy's driver being one of the gunmen?
Okay, I'm glad you asked me. I mentioned before that I knew William Cooper, and this is where we parted ways. William Cooper misinterpreted the Zapruder film and says that William Greer turned around and shot the president. Unfortunately, there are many frames missing from the Zapruder film, and certain actions that went down were removed because they were afraid the public would see them and misinterpret them. I have a still photograph that shows that William Greer did draw his gun. But the reason he drew his gun is that the first shot was almost street level, that hit President Kennedy in the back and gave him time to say, "Oh my God, I've been shot." And this is Greer's testimony. And Greer and Kellerman, they turned around and saw that the president was hurt. And unwittingly, Greer hit the brake. When you're driving and you turn around, you don't generally keep driving, you know. There were two reasons he hit the brake. That was one of them. The other one was when he saw the people over the overpass. But my belief is that William Greer heard the shot, heard the president say, "I've been shot," turned around, and saw in the vestibule of the Texas school book depository, one of the assailants, and he drew his gun and fired at that fellow. There was a big, wide space between Jackie, who was on the far left of the limousine, and Jack, who was on the far right. But this separation is lost when you see it on in film. And since the bullet that hit the throat arrived so quickly thereafter, I believe that the real untouched Zapruder film would have shown the president getting hit in the back and saying, "Oh my God, I've been shot." Greer turning around, instinctively drawing his gun and taking a shot at the guy whom he knew shot the president, the first guy. And then the throat shot would have arrived and hit President Kennedy in the throat, and this would have made it look like Greer shot the president. So this era, this has been excised, along with other intervals that have been cut out. And if you compare the original Zapruder film as it was presented through the Men Who Killed Kennedy, for example, through the 1980s and the 90s, with the recently released digitized version, you'll see that there are many more movements of people in the background and physical body actions that are missing from the first version of the Zapruder film.
All right.
So, no, I don't believe that Mr. Greer shot the president. I think he was one of the another one of the unwitting victims of November 22nd. He cried. He cried his eyes out in the hospital. He begged Mrs. Kennedy for forgiveness for what he thought was his lapse, his oversight. I don't think a cold-blooded killer would have done that.
All right. Now, you have put forth a theory of the assassination that has, without question, raised eyebrows and rocked boats. It's pretty startling, but even more so when you stop to think of the ramifications of this politically, in that what you're describing is a planned, organized coup d'etat.
And at the top of the list, the man who benefited most from it, the man who was going to be impeached that very afternoon, was Lyndon Baines Johnson. Johnson was on his way to the calaboose, as some of my friends used to say in Texas.
Why?
He'd been impeached, and the vote was coming down that afternoon.
Why?
The death of President Kennedy precluded that vote of impeachment, ushered him into the highest office in the nation, gave him the ability to control every investigative organ from the Dallas Police Department to the FBI.
All right, but why was he being impeached?
He was being impeached because of the corruption that had been exposed in his dealings with Bobby Baker, collecting shopping bags full of bribes, and his association with the mafia in the opening of certain Atlantic City casinos, and primarily for his participation with Billy Sol Estes in a huge federal land scam deal where he was able to procure hundreds of thousands of acres at in a paltry price, 50 cents an acre or so, to his friend Billy Sol Estes, who turned it over for huge profits, having some background information, insider information, on plans to use the land. So all of that had been exposed, and Johnson had become a public embarrassment to Kennedy. Kennedy had exiled him from Washington that summer. If you go back to Time magazine around June, July 1963, you'll see an issue specifically on this, and I devoured it.
All right, now one quick question. Lyndon Johnson here. I have heard, and I've never seen it documented, that he made a statement to someone. I believe he said something like, "By Friday night, everything will be okay."
That's tomorrow, yeah. That's Madeline Brown again, and I heard this directly from her twice. I heard it from her in a 3-hour phone call that I had with her, and I heard it from her in Dallas when I saw her in 1996. After tomorrow, those bastard Kennedys will never embarrass me in public again. He was in a rage. And the rage was very interesting. The precipitation of the rage was that he wanted to swap Governor Connally with his arch enemy, Senator Ralph Yarborough. because it was clear that President Kennedy was down in Dallas actually being invited by Johnson to come and heal the party, which was fragmented. And he had made clear to Johnson that he was not going to be on the ticket in 1964, yet Kennedy was astute enough to know he had to have a Texan on the ticket. So he was there, basically, in my opinion, to anoint either Governor Connally or Senator Yarborough as his running mate to make that deal and bump Johnson. So Yarborough was the arch enemy of Lyndon Johnson, and Connally was his friend. And he tried everything in his power to get Kennedy to switch Governor Connally and Governor Yarborough's seat in the motorcade, which would have facilitated some things for him. But Kennedy was adamant, and he had a huge explosive argument with him and dismissed him. This was in Fort Worth. And if you want this story, Todd Zerbel wrote The Texas Connection, which contains much of this information and some very interesting pictures of Johnson in his relationship with Kennedy.
We've got less than a minute left. I want to ask you something. Does this mean we do not live in a constitutional free America?
I think the Constitution went out the window with the Warren Commission and the subsequent assassinations and cover-ups of the death of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy, the attempted assassination on Ronald Reagan, on and on. It's just like a standard SOP, you know, a standard operating procedure, it seems to me. And you as a policeman, a former policeman, can recognize the pattern very readily, you know.
Well, Robert, I want to thank you for being here and being brave enough to talk about this out in public.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
I have.
I respect you very much, and I always feel protected by the truth. You know, ironically, I was discussing the Gospels of St. John. That
I hate to do it, but the music started, and our mics will go dead momentarily. Folks, that's it. That's a wrap. I hope you enjoyed the show. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do, too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until tomorrow, so long, everybody.